Welcome to the Investing Insights Podcast from Morningstar.com. This podcast is brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds. There are big investment opportunities beyond our borders. Megatrends is a podcast from Oppenheimer Funds that explores the trends reshaping the global economy. Subscribe to Megatrends wherever you listen. This week on the podcast, Christine Benn shares three equity funds from her model portfolios for retirees. Damian Conover reveals what he expects from Big Pharma this earnings season. Special guest Michael Kitsis talks about the role likability plays when choosing an advisor. Sarah Bush explains why a well-liked bond fund was recently downgraded. Eric Compton discusses what bank earnings say about the health of the economy. And Russ Kinnell shares four of his favorite niche funds. Let's get started. First, Christine Benz on equity funds for retirees.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski from Morningstar.com. Today's retirees need their portfolios to last for two decades or more. Stocks can provide some much-needed growth during the drawdown phase. Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance, Christine Benz, includes three stock funds in her model portfolios for retirees. She's here today to discuss them with us. Christine, thank you for joining us today.
Susan, it's great to be here.
Now, your retirement portfolios include stock funds and that very last bucket, bucket three.
Right.
And the stock fund that takes up the largest percentage of assets in that bucket is Vanguard Dividend Appreciation. Why this fund in particular?
This fund is available as either an exchange-traded fund or as a traditional mutual fund. The reason I like it, Susan, is that it is focused on companies that have had a history of growing or increasing their dividends. That tends to anchor it in financially healthy firms. A big share of this portfolio is classified as wide moat stocks. So these are generally higher quality companies than the broad market. I like it because that tends to reduce the volatility relative to other stock funds. It's also very, very cheap. It charges just 8 basis points.
Oh, that's great. Now, you also do, speaking of the broader market,
yes,
you do include another Vanguard index fund in your portfolio, Vanguard Total Stock Market. How does that one fit in?
Well, this one could be one and done if you just wanted a single U.S. equity fund, this would be the one that I would use. The reason I use it as a complement to the dividend appreciation fund is that it provides some exposure to sectors that are somewhat lacking in the dividend appreciation fund. So it's broadly diversified. It has exposure to technology stocks, for example, which tend not to pay very large dividends, certainly. So it's a good complement, or it's a good sole standalone holding. It's also very, very cheap, in fact, cheaper than dividend appreciation.
And then you round things out with a little bit of an international flavor with American Funds International Growth and Income. Tell us a little bit about that fund.
Yeah, this is a fund that is run by American Funds Capital Research Group. It has multiple managers, but they're all applying what we think is a very sensible strategy. They look for dividend-paying firms, by and large. And one thing that people might not know about American Funds products is that they are available through Schwab in the F share class without any sales charge and without any transaction fee. So a lot of people might say, American Funds, that's for load investors. Yeah. Not so. You can access the funds through Schwab.
That's great. A lot of good ideas for retirees today. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you for tuning in. I'm Susan Jabinski from Morningstar.com.
Overwhelmed by the market? Morningstar Premium will help you cut through the noise and find the most promising investments. Get started today with Morningstar Premium.
Next, Damian Conover with a Big Pharma earnings season preview.
As we approach the first quarter earnings for the large cap pharmaceutical stocks, there's a lot of important themes that we think investors should be aware of. One of the key themes will likely be commentary about drug rebating. Over the last couple months, we've had congressional hearings about the potential to eliminate drug rebates. And this is really an effort to try to make drug pricing more transparent. And we expect commentary from a lot of the firms to explain what this potentially means for the outlook of sales growth. When we unpackage this outlook, we think it's going to be really beneficial, especially for firms that don't do a lot of drug rebating. Firms like Roche, Celgene, Bristol. We think these firms are well positioned in a rebate-free sort of environment. But there are other firms that really lean into rebating. These are firms like AstraZeneca, Eli Lilly. It could be more of a challenge for them. But in the whole scope of things, we think more transparency should largely be good for the large cap drug firms. Another key theme we're looking at in the first quarter results is how the next generation drugs are doing and really the ability for these next generation drugs to offset drugs facing generic and biosimilar competition. Johnson & Johnson is, I think, a good example of what we're looking for in this example. They have a key molecule called Remicade that is facing biosimilar competition, and we're anticipating this drug to lose about 20% of sales annually over the next several years. However, Johnson & Johnson also has a lot of great new molecules that are gaining increased traction. So when we look at J&J overall, we think the firm is well positioned for steady growth. However, on a valuation perspective, this is a firm that we think is largely fairly valued. Nevertheless, has a strong, wide economic moat that we think will protect its profits over a long term. Shifting gears to a few other firms that we think are undervalued, and we anticipate this quarter's earnings results to help guide us to more granularity on some of the valuations, Bayer is a name that we think is undervalued. We anticipate this quarter's results to really show fundamental growth within its core business and to talk a little bit more about the litigation around the glyphosate concerns, which we think has caused an undue amount of pressure on this specific stock. The last name I'd mention here is AbbVie. This is a firm also facing biosimilar competition against Humira, one of its key molecules. However, it's got a lot of great next generation molecules in oncology, immunology that we think will support long-term growth. In aggregate, when we're looking at the quarter, we think large pharmaceutical stocks will report solid earnings that really should help give us more granularity around the drug rebates that potentially could be eliminated, as well as more granularity around some of the new drug launches offsetting products losing exclusivity to generics and biosimilar competition.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Now, Michael Kitsis on the likability factor when choosing an advisor.
Hi, I'm Karen Wallace from Morningstar. How much does likability matter when initially choosing an advisor? And what role does it play in maintaining an ongoing relationship with that advisor? Here to discuss this is financial planning expert Michael Kitsis. Michael, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Karen. Good to be here today.
So you recently had a discussion with Carl Richards on your blog,
yes,
where you tackled this question of likability. And it sort of goes beyond just politeness. It sort of goes into communication styles and authenticity.
Yep.
Can you discuss what role these play as an advisor?
So this is a kind of an interesting challenge to me. I think from both the advisor end, what we try to do to be successful with our clients, and from the investor end, how do you find and pick your advisor? Because there's been this longstanding challenge out there that you look at some of the consumer surveys and nobody trusts their financial services institution, but everybody likes their individual advisor. I don't know about the firm, but my guy or my gal is a good person and I like them. All right, that's great. I don't want to denigrate anyone, but how do you actually know they're any good and doing the right thing? Well, they're really nice. I like them a lot. But how do you actually know they're any good and they're doing the right thing? There's this challenge, I think, in the world of trying to find an advisor where, it's an intangible service. I don't know if they're really going to, I don't know if the advice is good until 5, 10, 20, 30 years from now when I look back and hopefully say, wow, my advisor gave me good advice. That went really well. I'm so glad I did those things. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to evaluate. It's even really hard to evaluate shortly after the fact. You often don't know until way later whether this advice was actually good and helpful and fruitful. And the challenge I think it creates is, and I have a lot of sympathy for this from the investor end, it gets really hard to pick an advisor. Literally, what are you going to go on? How are you going to choose? And what is it often not coming back to? Well, I feel like I get along with them. I like them. I like my advisor. And not that I'm negative on having a relationship with an advisor that you like, but that I'm not sure should necessarily be the best driver of this person can give me advice based on my accumulated life savings that I've worked 30 years for because he or she is a nice person.
Right.
To me, from the advisor end, I think this is still a sort of a cross that we have to bear to some extent. I can't give someone good advice if they don't like me, don't want to communicate with me. This is not going to work as a relationship. And so there is at least some burden on us as advisors to try to be at least reasonably likable and polite and have reasonable rapport in company. And sometimes especially when we have to sort of give hard advice and deliver hard medicine. But I think from the investor end, as you're thinking about this and working with advisors, I would caution people about framing it too much as, well, I just want to make sure I like my advisor. Because frankly, if they're going to give you hard advice, I actually hope you don't like them sometimes, because sometimes that's part of, you know, giving people hard advice they need to hear. And what I encourage instead is just think about it from a communication style end. Like, you do need to be able to communicate with them well. You don't necessarily need to enjoy breaking bread with them and playing golf with them and doing social stuff with them, but you do need to communicate well with them. And people communicate in different ways. Some are very visual and do a great job drawing pictures and telling stories. If that's what works for you, that's great. Other people love to delve into the numbers. So find yourself an advisor that loves delving into the numbers as much as you do. You have a right to demand and insist that. If you can't find an advisor that can communicate what you need to see and hear, find a different one who does. But just would caution, like, sheer likability alone, you know, unfortunately, Bernie Madoff was a likable guy.
Right.
In fact, part of the reason why con men are successful at what they do is because they're very likable people who then don't always tell all the truths. And, you know, certainly not to imply that all likable people are cons or all likable advisors are cons, but you have to go a step deeper into, are they actually competent? Do they have some credentials? Do they know what they're talking about? And communication matters, but saying, can I communicate with this person, is different than trying to just find someone you like.
Right, right. So you, ideally, you want somebody who can explain things that you don't understand to you clearly, and someone you can trust to kind of tell you when you're on the wrong track.
Yeah, as I kind of view it, it sort of boils down to three pieces that are very related. One, just, is the communication there? Just, can they explain things to me the way I need to hear them and have them explained to me? And, you know, we all take in information differently. So one advisor could be fantastic for one person, is a terrible fit for another, because the styles are just different. I think the second driver is essentially what I would call competency. Like, just, do they actually have the expertise? Do they actually have the knowledge? Like, I find sometimes we sort of forget, like, oh, they also have to actually know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, not just communicate well, but communicate things that are factual and knowledgeable and accurate. The unfortunate reality in the advisor industry is our minimum standards are very low. You know, doctors have to go to med school and lawyers have to go to law school. Financial advisors don't have to go to financial advisor school. Our minimum regulatory requirements are a fairly simple minimum exam just to make sure we know the laws that apply to us. So looking for things like CFP certification, other advanced designations, and the experience just to be competent matters. So communication is the first, competency is the second. And then the third, I think it does still come down to trust. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily likability per se, although it's hard to trust people I completely dislike, but do you trust them? Mm-hmm. I mean, if they're going to give you advice, do you trust the advice? Because if you're going to spend all of your time second guessing and error checking and back checking your advisor, you're not getting very much leverage and, you know, time savings and efficiency out of this relationship as an advisor. Find someone that you can trust enough that when they do give you the advice, you're comfortable and willing to take it. And if you just fundamentally don't trust them, that should be the biggest warning flag of all, that you need another advisor. Not that they have to be a bad person, but if you can't place that trust in them, find someone that you can.
Okay, that's really great advice. Thanks so much for being here to discuss it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Karen.
For Morningstar, I'm Karen Wallace. Thanks for watching.
This podcast is brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds. There are big investment opportunities beyond our borders. Megatrends is a podcast from Oppenheimer Funds that explores the trends reshaping the global economy. Subscribe to Megatrends wherever you listen. Next, Sarah Bush on a well-liked fund that was recently downgraded.
Despite a recent downgrade of its Morningstar analyst rating from gold to silver, there's still a lot to like about Lumisail's bond. A team of veteran managers, including bond fund legend Dan Fuss, skipper of the fund. They're backed by one of the deepest credit analyst teams in the business, as well as dedicated sovereign and macro researchers. That depth is important because the team's approach is wide-ranging. The fund has the flexibility to invest across corporate bonds, convertibles, and non-US dollar debt, and will venture into emerging markets. Even the occasional stock pops up in the portfolio. This mix typically makes this fund one of the most aggressive in the multi-sector bond category, and it's vulnerable to steep losses in weak equity and credit markets. Meanwhile, modest concerns about concentration risk in the portfolio led to the fund's recent downgrade to silver. That said, the team's combination of a research-driven and often contrarian approach gives this fund plenty of appeal. The managers take advantage of downdrafts in the credit markets to identify bargains, as they did starting in mid-2014 when junk bond prices fell sharply. At that point, they found good opportunities in larger and well-known issuers, as well as commodity-driven names that were hurt by plunging oil prices. The fund turned in big losses in 2015 when these names and its currency exposure suffered, but rebounded sharply in 2016 and 2017. Over the long haul, investors who've been patient have been well served here.
Go from one investment analyst to 150. Sign up today for Morningstar Premium and let our independent and unbiased research staff help you find the best investments. Get started today with Morningstar Premium.
Now, Eric Compton on bank earnings and the health of the economy.
All of the big four U.S. banks have reported earnings, giving us greater insight into the overall health of the U.S. banking industry. While many have been worried about an imminent recession and a flattening yield curve, underlying bank operating performances remain strong. We have been paying close attention to management commentary on the economy, loan growth, and credit metrics to gauge how healthy the economy actually is. So far, commentary has been largely positive. Core loan growth is still decent for most of the banks, with several even highlighting middle market strength, and the credit environment remains benign. Yield curve aside, many of the fundamentals still look okay. For Citigroup, results were mixed. The bank contained costs well and is already getting close to hitting their full-year return on tangible equity target. However, the bank is lagging from a growth perspective. While growth isn't perfect, even moderate growth combined with continued expense control should reasonably have Citi meeting or getting very close to its profitability goals, which is a welcome development for a franchise that has historically struggled here, and shares look relatively cheap to us. JP Morgan has firmly established itself as the most profitable bank among the big four. Despite a difficult trading and issuance environment, the bank hit new highs for returns on tangible equity. We do not expect much improvement for the bank from here, but do think the bank can sustain these returns without a turn in the credit environment. For Wells Fargo, results were once again disappointing. Management guided down on their net interest income outlook, and while they stuck to their expense guidance, they admitted that they were spending more on compliance issues than they previously expected. The return on tangible equity did stay at 15%, but without a long-term CEO and more work to be done on the regulatory side, Wells still has a long way to go. Bank of America, similar to many peers, also saw slowing revenue growth, but expense control and share repurchases drove EPS growth. The bank stuck to full-year expense guidance and is growing core deposit relationships, wealth assets, and commercial loans. We like where B of A is positioned competitively and think there could be room for improving profitability in the future.
Can your portfolio weather the market? Use our premium portfolio tools to identify risks and streamline your holdings. Get started today with Morningstar Premium.
And lastly, Russ Kinnell with his favorite niche funds.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com. Investors with truly diversified portfolios might consider holding a few specialized funds around the margins of their portfolios. Joining me to share a few of his favorites is Russ Kinnell. He's Director of Manager Research for Morningstar. Russ, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Russ, let's talk about specialized funds. When we talk about specialized or niche funds, what kinds of funds are we talking about?
They're often areas that focus on small parts of the market. In other words, the total market cap isn't that big, so it could be a certain region or an investment type that's not that big. And generally, when we look to these, we're looking for some mix of diversification because it doesn't act like the broad market and or value add, so good little niche alpha generators. So useful players used in moderation.
Okay. So that was my next question. If I want to use some of these funds that we're going to be talking about, what should be on my to-do list first? I assume that I should have a well-thought-out asset allocation plan and some of the core-type funds first.
That's right. Build out your core. And I think niche funds are fine, but you don't want to build a portfolio that's all these niche funds. Niche funds can be kind of exciting. You hear about something in the headlines, you buy a fund. You don't want to have 10 of these funds taking up a third of your portfolio. So be disciplined. Have a couple. Don't go crazy with them.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the ones that you really like. One is a foreign smaller cap fund. So this would be maybe a complement. If I have my core international stock holding, I might hold a little bit of this one as well. This is an Artisan fund. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Artisan International Small and Mid Cap is run by Rezo Kanovic, who came over from Oppenheimer in October of 2018. And he really changed the fund into an aggressive growth fund. If you saw him at Oppenheimer, he had tremendous success with that strategy. But to me, because it's a very aggressive strategy, I don't think it's really a core holding. I think it's one I might make, say, 5% of my portfolio. Again, very aggressive investor. And I like the fact that right now it's a fairly small fund, under $1 billion. Artisan has a good record of closing funds before they get too big. Oppenheimer's a little more shaky at closing funds, so I like it when a manager goes from that kind of shop to one like Artisan. So I see a lot of positives there. But again, I would be cautious because it is an aggressive fund.
Okay. When you and I were talking about which funds to talk about here, you sent me three Matthews funds. We settled on one. First, let's talk about what you and the team like so much about Matthews and what their specialty is.
Yeah, so their specialty is investing in Asia, and they do it really well with a big team of managers and analysts all dedicated to Asia. They typically favor kind of a growth at reasonable price strategy, tend to be a little lower in market cap, so they're not just owning Samsung or the household names. They go beneath that. And so we really come to like them as a firm that just has a lot of expertise, a lot of people who make a career investing in Asia.
Okay, so Matthews Emerging Asia is the fund that you're highlighting here?
Right, so this is very much a niche fund. If the Artisan fund was a 5%, this one maybe should only be a 2% because it's a niche within a niche. It's focusing on emerging Asia. And so what that means is forget about Korea, Hong Kong, and China, the giants of Asia.
Or Japan.
Or Japan. This is a fund that's investing in Pakistan and Bangladesh and some of the Sri Lanka, some of the smaller markets.
Okay.
So again, I think it's got a sensible approach. You have very experienced managers, despite it being a relatively small fund in a small niche. So I like all of those things, but again, it's a niche fund. You have much lower correlations with the U.S. market. It's about a 30 correlation with the IFA as well, and so it's a better diversifier because these markets move differently. But again, they truly are emerging markets with higher risk. It actually has a lower standard deviation than the S&P 500, but don't trust that. It's a high-risk strategy.
Okay. And these two funds, the Artisan Fund and the Matthews Fund, they're also not cheap relative to my big core foreign stock fund, most likely.
That's right. That's another reason to keep these funds at a small amount. They're cheap relative to their peers in those categories. Particularly the Matthews funds are generally pretty cheap. But right, they are pricier. So that's another reason you want to keep that smaller. Stay with the most your portfolio should be in low-cost core funds.
Okay. Another fund that you like, a U.S.-focused fund, is Fidelity Select Healthcare. This is one space where you'd want to do a good survey of what you've already got in your portfolio before adding on dedicated healthcare exposure, right?
That's right. Your typical growth fund is going to have meaningful healthcare exposure, so it's a good thing to run your portfolio through Morningstar X-ray or some other tool that says, how much do I have exposure to this area before you add to it? But I think what's appealing here is that Fidelity's built a really good team of analysts under Eddie Yoon. They have 15 dedicated healthcare analysts with a wide range of medical specialties. And so they really know the space. So to me, this is a space where you can really get some good value add. But again, you're right. In this case, you're going to have some overlap. It's not going to be as much a diversifier as an alpha generator for you.
Okay. The last fund on your list is, I think, truly a interesting diversifier idea. So if I've got my core equity, my core fixed income, Gateway Fund is another fund to consider. Let's talk about that one.
Right. This is a very different from the other ones we've talked about. It's going to be less volatile and less risky than the market, whereas the other ones potentially are much riskier. The idea here is they own essentially the broad market, but then they do a collar strategy with options. And what that does is it significantly lowers the upside and the downside. So in a strong bull market, it might only get a third of the upside. In a strong bear market, it might only lose half as much. So it's a really nice diversifier in that way. But I think, to me, the cost here is, the risk here is a little sneaky. It's kind of opportunity cost, right? That you're giving up. You could have put that money in a straight equity fund and had greater upside even with the downside. So again, to me, that says it's still a niche fund, but it's a nice diversifier. It's a nice way to tone down some of that equity risk.
Okay, Russ, interesting ideas. Thank you so much for being here to discuss them with us.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.com.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast for Morningstar.com. We hope you've enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@Morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening.
Sponsored by Oppenheimer Funds, a leader in global investing.